Welcome to the Feudal Podcast. We are now recording. If you want to send us emails, you can send us emails to futilepodcast@gmail.com. We are back. We took sort of a week off there and screwed around, kind of...
dicked around.
Yeah, well, figuratively. And, like, when is that not figurative?
What you been doing? Dicking around.
Yeah.
Go ahead, snoop around. I always think of Ace Ventura anytime I hear dicking around. It's like, just snoop around.
And
do you remember what Ace Ventura's landlord's name was?
No.
It was a really ridiculous name. And when he first hears his name, he goes, Ventura. And he stops and he doesn't look at him. He goes, yes, Satan. And he looks around. Oh, man. It's such a stupid
name. That actor played the mathematician in Pi.
Right.
And he was also one of he's McCall's. He was the Equalizer's, one of the Equalizer's, like, go-to guys. Yeah. Him and Mickey Kosmeyer.
Gosh, now that my internet's magically working, I can look up the guy's name. He was in, like, the Godfather movies and, like...
I don't remember him from the Godfather movies. I usually notice him, but he did a lot of TV work and a lot of, like, I'd say character actor stuff, and usually nothing super big.
But he was in an episode of Seinfeld or two.
Possibly.
I forget who played in that, but...
Yeah.
Oh, I totally forgot. Let's see if I can remember his name.
Let's definitely.
See. Oh, they don't have the plot. Yeah, Chicken Dance. Mr. Chicken Dance.
Like, just, it all happened so fast, right? So I'm looking at my hands, just... gashed up. I got like a big old chunk. Anyway, ruined my weekend.
You know, it's amazing that...
So I decided to watch Schindler's List.
You know,
and Black Hawk Down, and American Gangster, Big Fish.
I feel bad. You know, I watch Schindler's List, and I'm always moved by it. And then anytime there's any sort of movie joke to be made off the top of my head, the first movie on the list is Schindler's List, usually. And I did that at work the other day. I think I might have told you this, but I crack wise about Schindler's List. And I think one of these days there's going to be some sort of hardcore Jew in my company that is going to, like, take umbrage at it. But somebody said, my boss, I have to sit next... There's this big company meeting. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting next to my boss, and I'm taking notes, and because the meeting is about my department, basically. And there's 50 people in the room. And
50 people?
I am the head of...
50 people.
I am, yes.
So, like, all these people, like, it's like their day off and stuff. They have to come in for this one meeting for half an hour.
I did, too. No, it was a three-hour meeting.
Oh, my God.
And
because there's problems or something?
Oh, there's always problems, yeah.
But three hours is, like, a standard operating procedure.
I actually missed the last hour because I had to go up front and open the store.
Oh,
so,
my God.
Yeah, it was 7 in the morning. There was 50 people in the room. And I knocked him dead, man. I knocked him dead. I was like a stand-up, except for I was sitting down, slumping, kind of.
Uh-huh.
And the best killer in the room was, my boss started talking about checks. She says, listen, you got to be able to, when checks come in, I want you to, you know, if the system takes it, it'll take it. If it doesn't, that means there's something wrong with it. And it could be, and she said, what's that movie to me? Lightning fast. The moment she said it, I said Schindler's List, and everyone just lost.
Because of checks.
Yeah, no, it wasn't had anything to do with that. I just said Schindler's List.
No, but Czechoslovakia.
No one but you would possibly even go that far.
Uh-huh.
It was just very simple. I could have said anything. I could have said the Temple of Doom. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I said Schindler's List, and
it sounds like
lost it.
You've got a low-end crowd there. I mean, they're too easy.
No, the smarter people in the room lost it. Other people kind of looked at me like I was retarded.
Uh-huh.
The people who knew what Schindler's List was.
Probably an uncomfortable thing, yeah.
Anyway, she was like, what? No. She goes, Catch Me If You Can, the movie about check forging.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, yeah, you know. I realized then that was like the third Schindler's List reference that I had made in the last week to random people at work when they say, what's that movie? And I go, Schindler's List? Because I don't know why. I think that, like, they're probably going to tell me any other movie but Schindler's List.
Yeah.
And Schindler's List is this sad, long, you know, brilliant drama.
It's like 2 hours and 40 minutes or something.
And it really is a great movie. I think, you know, Spielberg does excel at a certain type of drama.
Yeah,
he's known as, I mean, before he made Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, stuff like that, before he made those,
it was Jurassic Park.
He was going to go down in history as the Jaws, Jurassic Park, E.T. guy, which is great family stuff, exciting movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's made the biggest blockbusters.
Whimsical, childlike sensibilities.
But he was always going to have the knock on him that this guy could not win a Best Director Oscar because he was not a great drama filmmaker.
Yeah.
And suddenly, and I think he realized, you know what, I'm going to have to do this. And I think he's proven that.
Well, he'd been waiting on it for a while.
He'd been sitting on it since like the 70s or something.
Yeah,
like that.
And he was. It was really tough for him.
It was. I'm sure it was.
To shoot it and everything.
But I mean, I think you take out a little bit of schlockiness. There's just something about schlockiness.
I can
and the
see
sappiness
that too. In this movie,
it's in every movie. It's in all of them.
You didn't need it.
It's
this
probably
movie.
In Jurassic Park. Now, if I try to think about it, not so much in those movies, but those are really popcorn movies. But Schindler's List really has a minimum amount of that, I think.
It's minimum, but it's still like
Saving Private Ryan has it in droves because of the stupid bookends he puts in, where he's trying to jerk a few tears out of you with the old guy who's supposed to be Matt Damon at the beginning and the end. Stuff like that, you know. But, you know, the point of movies is, I think he takes
stir
movies
an emotional
the
thing,
point of movies, you know, is really to kind of evoke emotion from the viewer. And there, it comes to a point now where people are so, they want to be intellectually kind of prodded awake.
Well, it's an issue if you're a cinema person, then you want to be deconstructing it, and if you deconstruct it to, oh, it's that again.
Well, not just that, but it's like
then you're not enjoying. You're not passively watching
it. There's
kind
of an elitist type of film person who doesn't like when the manipulation emotions will still happen.
Yeah,
and then you feel upset that it happened to you.
I kind of get
like,
that.
Why
way.
Did this happen? It really upsets me that it happened to me in Armageddon.
Yeah,
I've
exactly.
Told you the story.
Exactly.
I think Scheer doesn't like to be manipulated like that.
Well,
he likes a good intellectual film, and he's shown us. Some of my favorite movies are his favorite. Also, when he showed The Conversation, I love that film.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
It's a great thinking movie, and it's got the kind of twisty little plot and pieces and stuff like that. It's a really smart movie, brilliantly directed, brilliantly edited. The sound was fantastic in it. Great acting, just this great overall like thriller type thing. Saving Private Ryan, overall, was also a movie like that, and it's. I think Spielberg has proven that if you're going to go throughout all history and pick out all the directors who you might be able to call the greatest director of all time, they're all going to have little bits of flaws in there. I don't count Spielberg's movies among some of my favorite. I literally think he's probably the greatest film director of all time.
Where there's a minor flaw in that. I want to talk about character study versus narrative. Because we can do that with a conversation. We can do that with the Mammoth films and stuff too. I think because there's sort of I saw Down by Law, the Jim Jarmusch film. I don't know. You're not really a Jarmusch fan.
No, I saw it.
You've seen it. But that's a character study sort of thing. I listened to his commentary on it. In the directing class, Scheer was talking about how a big part of being a good director is talking to actors and stuff, and he said that Spielberg has admitted that he's not an actor's director. So
he gets damn good performances.
I don't know if it's
though.
Him. I think there's more going on there. So it's probably people are bringing acting coaches in or something. Possibly.
I think people put too much emphasis on what the director does to an actor. I think a bad actor's director will definitely get a crap performance out of the actors. But think about this: George Lucas gets crap for Hayden Christensen. You know what? I've seen Hayden Christensen in a lot of movies, and he's crap in all of them.
Uh-huh.
You know? I'm finding it harder and harder to pin that on him. Natalie Portman is a pretty wooden actress. I didn't think she was great in V for Vendetta. I thought she was... George Lucas gets a bad rap for that. He's not a good person's director. But Ewan McGregor, Samuel L. Jackson, they were good in those movies still. They still were good in those movies because they're good actors.
Yeah, I think that that's
so
the difference between them
that,
being really good actors, though.
It is, but I think the point is, you get a difference.
Well, there's a give and take
there.
There's
much emphasis on that. The people put too much on the director's power over that.
But the director's, that's really his job on set, is to be making
sure
that
the director's job
performance
is to make sure that the idea in his mind of how the shot was supposed to look ends up that way.
Yeah, but that's pre-production with the cinematographer. The cinematographer handles the visuals. The director, works with the cinematographer to craft that. Right. But the director on set is the one telling the actor, okay, you do this. You pick up the glass this way. And you see it in Mammoth films because he's definitely directing his actors to get a certain kind of performance. And that, I think, is really key to getting the most intense performances. Now, I didn't have a problem with the performances in Schindler's List. I think... I held off from watching it for so long, partially because of this sort of I don't know, there's this whole sort of connection with all that stuff. All the Holocaust pictures and stuff can sometimes be, they're pretty heavy to watch and all that stuff. And so I wanted to make sure that I was just in the mood to sit through it and make it through it and wasn't going to just, you know, be really off-put by it. I generally don't like stuff like that I feel it could just be like a seriously intense thing. But I overestimated the intensity of it, to be honest, which sounds weird, but I think I walked in when my brother was watching it one time, and it was, like, right at probably one of the most intense parts where, like, you know, they've got people all naked out in the middle of the thing, and they're all screaming and crying, and I'm like, wow, this movie's probably just 2 hours of this, you know? It's really not, and it's not. It's almost none of that.
It follows Schindler through his social circles.
And yeah, exactly.
Snaking around. And
it's a character study on this guy who, I mean, it's interesting. It's like at the beginning, how much of this had he planned out? How much did he know? Seemed like he was pretty much just a capitalist. He was going to try to figure out a way to get slave labor and profiteer. But by the end, either he's gone through a full real arc, or it's just becoming that much more clear that that's what he always sort of intended. Because he doesn't need to be convinced at any point towards the later half of the movie. It seems like he changes really pretty
he all does, of a sudden. I think he
like
quickly,
he's like, we're not going to be building, no shells that come out of here will work.
Yeah. And I think he very quickly finds a conscience. I don't know if he had a plan from the very beginning. I see where someone could think that. I think he very quickly found that I can't go through with any of this if it means hurting somebody.
Well, the part he did have planned definitely is in that first scene where he's smoking the cigarettes, looking real stoic and real like intent on those Nazis that come in. That he's got this whole, his whole thing is that he's like, those guys are going to be my friends. Those guys are going to be worth something, and I can use them to further my business ventures in this political climate that will facilitate a certain scenario. And that's basically what it comes down to. And then he does that, and then, you know, he accomplishes something pretty reasonable. But it feels like a lot of the complexity of what must have happened in that real situation gets kind of written off or simplified, like, and then they just say, oh, 7 months of this happened and there was no big deal. Like, it seems really far-fetched that they could have, without incredible strain, managed to just have a factory that produced shit for 7 months straight. I mean, the Nazis were very thorough. They kept their lists and they did their double checking, and it's almost like once they get to Czechoslovakia, they're kind of like under the radar for those 7 months. Yeah. And there's just this like troop of kind of like no count, you know, backwater.
Well, the thing is, I mean, they made a great deal of, they put a great deal of effort into pointing out that he was in with certain influential people in the party who would allow him to. I mean, it's the sort of thing where, like, I think one of the points of that movie is that just like with communism, any sort of political affiliation, basically, they always end up falling apart because of the personal greed motivation factor, et cetera, et cetera, where you can't, you know, in every single sort of social structure where there's some sort of political thing in there, there's going to be some sort of corruption at the top because, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And the same reason why the communism thing falls apart, what history has proven, is the fact that at heart, everyone's a capitalist just because the human nature is the whole greed factor, and
you've got
whatever best helps yourself individually out is what's gonna, you know.
But then again, Schindler completely refutes that claim in the end by he becomes broke, he becomes penniless, but not entirely.
Entirely. And there's a point that where they're like, you know,
they're making the point that if he'd sold his car, he could have bought two more lives.
Right. When he starts feeling bad and
he starts to lose.
I think one interesting thing about that scene is that that might have been, you know, something that just came to him at the spur of the moment in real life. Like, you see all these people and you think, I could have saved more. And you suddenly think that, because he probably didn't think that up until that point.
But the thing is,
I wouldn't have. I would have thought, I did pretty well. And then when I see all those people, I'd think, I wonder how many people
I
didn't save.
I'm a conservative by nature, so I realized, in the scene where he's having Ben Kingsley type up all the names, and he's like, no, more. He's clearly thinking about how many he can get.
Yeah.
Which means that it's like he's not considering, maybe he's, you know, those things were probably necessary. I think it's just more of an after the fact. It's like, I probably could have done without this car. It's like, well, you needed the car. You also needed the money to buy all the booze for the Nazis at that one point to make them all placated and happy about how none of you will be, there will be no armed guards in the factory. Okay, now everybody have a drink. Mm-hmm. You know, so he needed money to grease the wheels and maintain this I mean, he needed to keep the pin on. He couldn't have sold right. the pin for a life. I mean, it was more just like him realizing like how there was a these lives had a price, and that ridiculous idea just kind of finally got to him, yeah. and it finally overwhelmed him because he was pretty on board the whole time. So that's what I think was really the point of the scene. I don't think it was that he didn't realize that.
Right. Well, no. What I'm saying is that it's a very human thing to suddenly realize when you're faced with that many people, when you see all these people that he's actually saved, and you're struck with the hugeness of the whole thing, and you realize, you know, these are like you see each individual person there, and you think I could have had more. And I think that you can look at it either way, and I think that's why I think it was a brilliant scene. And it could be taken sappily, but at the same time, yeah. I think that those are the things that people take as sappy in movies really are usually genuine human emotions that Spielberg finds interesting as a filmmaker.
It's tough. The thing is, and this might not be his fault entirely, and I'm a big, you know, I love me an Indiana Jones movie, and I love the Superman movies and stuff, so I like John Williams, but he almost always uses John Williams, and John Williams has a certain kind of, like, he draws out a certain kind of derivative, sappy, thematic aspect in his music a lot of times, which will almost always kind of get to you. The music in the film, I felt, was usually kind of a detraction from the intensity of the actual drama that was going on sometimes. Mm. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, the music. Here comes the music to emphasize that this is intense or that this is sad. And it's like, dude, you've got it in the imagery. You've got it in the... It's almost like that movie would have been better with a much more minimal soundtrack than it had. That's just my take on it. Now, obviously, I think this film was made in, what, like, 93 or something like that? It was, like, right after 93. Jurassic Park. And it's possible that people hadn't just really started doing that. They hadn't gotten to that level of, I don't know, pretentiousness about, like, now there's no soundtrack in the last half of the movie, you know? Even though the China Syndrome, made in the 70s, is apparently famous right. for not having any soundtrack or any score at all.
This was 93, yeah.
Yeah, 93.
Right after Jurassic Park, yeah.
And so that's really the only real problem I had with it. I was mainly surprised just because I thought, like I said, I thought it was going to be horrendous. Like, the whole thing was just going to be horrendous. And then I also thought it was going to be boring. I thought the parts with him and Ben Kingsley were going to just be kind of boring and kind of like, you know, they figure out a way. Or this guy's a real jerk the whole time, but he just kind of happenstance, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I guess that's the way that worked out. But it turns out that the character actually ended up being kind of compelling by about, like you said, about the third of the way into the yeah. film or something, you started to notice how he was working to manipulate situations and how that was, you know, like a good thing. I mean, like what you would do in that scenario where... I mean, you know, I'm enough of an arrogant jerk that I would think I would be a little more intense, but then I would just get shot in the back of the head and then be the end of me, you know?
Right.
But like with the Ralph Fiennes character...
That's the thing, is that the Schindler character, the main arcs... I mean, his arc is so quick.
Yeah.
The main thing his arc actually does is the film is about how he affects other people.
Yeah.
And by his steady pace and his steadfastness to his goal... The Ralph Fiennes character is fascinating in that film.
Yeah.
That's the character who twists and turns and changes in the film. And
well, and yes and no.
He doesn't end up changing, but the way he is moved by Schindler, you see human in him, and he's a monster.
Yeah.
When he starts out, and you see human in him. And that was a great acting job. I thought Ralph Fiennes was really good in that movie.
No, he was. Did he get any kind of win
nominated,
for that?
I think. I couldn't tell you for sure.
Because that was... I think that was a definite, like, Oscar-caliber performance. Yeah. But just like, you know, just the way he's carefully able to manipulate him, even for a little bit, it doesn't last because like you said, he's a psychopath, which yeah. is why guys like us love to watch movies about psychopaths yeah. because, you know, we're kind of in that elitist film thing too. That's why we're doing the podcast. Cause we can hold that candle a little
I'm
bit
such
as well.
An elitist.
And we're like, well, we just want to see an interesting character study about someone. It doesn't matter if he doesn't change. There doesn't need to be a beginning, middle, and end yeah. clear narrative. Sometimes it's just, if it's a funny character, American Psycho, something like that. But mentioning the whole thing about like real power is not killing, you know, real power is being the emperor that can forgive mm-hmm. and he forgives the kid. And then he looks at himself in the mirror for a few minutes, and then he goes out and he shoots the kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you know, he can't maintain it. So that was definitely fascinating. But then towards the end, when he's like, hey, let me turn the hose on so these people can cool off.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, sometimes it just seemed like so obvious that he was doing that Schindler was doing something clearly because he had sympathy for the Jews.
He got frantic at moments like that. You could see like the way he starts pacing and stuff. And, and I think that's why they were trying to show how Schindler was successful, was his frantic was about 12 steps lower than, say, your frantic, which would be you'd be pulling out hair and breaking computers and flipping over tables. And
there'd be a lot of computers being broken in Nazi Germany.
And he's able to fly under the radar with his, you know, he was so smooth.
Well, I can be smooth with his
you're not as smooth as Liam Neeson, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
Anyway, Neeson and Fiennes were both nominated for Best Actor and Supporting Actor. Fiennes won the BAFTA for Supporting Actor.
Well, that's good.
So they definitely got their nods for these things.
But, so it just, in a few spots, it almost seemed too light, I think. Basically, but that could have been just because I was so feeling it was going to be so crazily intense. There were some definitely some intense scenes. Mm-hmm. I won't lie about that. But, and it even had, like, some dark humor in it. When Fiennes is going to shoot that guy, and he can't get his gun to work, and the guy's like, check the pin, you know? Like, it was like something out of Pulp Fiction. And then, like, he gets the other gun, and then it doesn't work, and you're almost like, this is a little ridiculous.
It's sick.
And I'm like, Spielberg, really? Really? This seems like something, because he doesn't really do dark comedy ever. Like,
well, you know, I beg to differ, because just because it's so Hollywoodized and bright lights and stuff, the Raiders of Lost Ark films are really a lot of dark humor.
Oh, that's Ford.
If you think
right,
about killing people, like, and making a little joke out of it, that's dark humor always. And
I guess.
I think
it's got to be something that's like, it's like, the kind of dark humor I'm thinking of is like the stuff that's so like superficially like sort of intense, but then they throw in, you know, like the minor bit of like humanistic comedy realism to it, you know, like, well, maybe it's a pin, you know, talk it out, you know, like they're, Like he's trying to tighten a pipe or something, you know? But you're going to shoot some guy in the head. So, I mean, I cracked up that scene, which I thought, like, well, this is creepy. This is weird.
Right.
And then there were a couple other scenes. Like, there was like he had the obligatory couple of, like, seconds of comedic relief in there. In between, you know, other horrible stuff. So, I found it, I mean, it was a good film.
I think you're overlooking the fact that there's like a stigma about him not being as good an actor's director, just as there is with Lucas. Lucas really is crap compared to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lucas has got different focus.
He does.
I think that Lucas
needs to
not direct.
But I mean, yeah, no, you're right. But I mean,
he's got a great eye.
Even
though,
as a director, he's a great eye for something. But
well, no, I mean, like,
can do
that
as a producer too. You know, can be like, hey, you know, and point stuff out to a director. And a lot of producers, the directors are just their puppets, Jerry Bruckheimer and stuff like that. You know, these guys, Jerry Bruckheimer comes up with his own stories for movies, and then hires a screenwriter and a director and says, hey, develop this thing I just came up with into a movie. And he makes them up.
That's my kind of producer.
Him and Don Simpson had a notebook full of ideas. Every single movie that's ever been made under the Bruckheimer mantle almost is something that he came
like
up with.
Like Con Air or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Yeah, seriously. The Rock, all that stuff. It's all stuff he came up with in a notebook.
Cool.
I think that you look at something like Munich.
Mm-hmm.
I think Spielberg's fault ends up being that he's attempting to show people how much he is an actor's director, and or can be, that he ends up making... Munich takes very boring turns at times. And it's the plot. It's the plotting and the story that's too drawn out. I think the acting is fantastic all the way from Munich, and that's what keeps it interesting. Schindler's List, all the acting was great, and I don't think it was just because of Liam Neeson and Ralph Fiennes and stuff, because, you know, I can't, you know...
I won't fault that both those films... probably have a personal connection to Spielberg.
Yeah.
And so it's very likely that he's a better actor's director when he's got that, like, legitimate go-to
Catch Me If You
personal
Can
thing.
Is boring as hell. I saw it in the theater. It bored the hell out of me.
But
that's
the check forging.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought the acting was great in it, and all the way through. And I wouldn't say it's just because of Leonardo DiCaprio. It was a different kind of role for him. He had a certain accent and stuff, and Tom Hanks had a certain accent.
He's done that sort of cocky, smart-ass.
But the thing is, Leonardo DiCaprio plays, you know, Scorsese doesn't get good performances out of him, except for, I thought he was great in The Departed. I thought he was crap in Gangs of New York. I didn't like him in Blood Diamond. He plays it's his voice really bothers me. In The Departed, he went nuts in a few parts, and you could tell this was just breaking him to pieces.
Well, that character was so sympathetic, though. It was hard not to just, like, completely be on his side.
Yeah.
Just to see what he went through, how he showed that was great.
Yeah. How he showed it was great. I mean, I think Spielberg gets that out of almost every actor he puts to the thing. So I think that just because he has a little touch of schmaltz to him, people kind of push him to the wayside when it comes to someone like, oh, you can't compare him to, like, David Lean, or you can't compare him to Norman Jewison, or, you know, somebody
I think doing a lot of that is really ultimately kind of an idiotic thing. I think comparing directors is usually kind of, I mean, either you like the stories that they're working with, and we've talked about directors before, you know, they all have, like you said, they all have their flaws. I think Kubrick sometimes is a bit, I don't know if it would be self-indulgent, but he takes his time sometimes too much, and critics will talk about it praisingly, like, he's willing to, you know, bore you to drive you to the point of boredom.
2001 is a minimalist movie in every way except for time.
Yeah, I love that film though.
I can't tell you a single line from the film that wasn't spoken by a robot. I can barely even remember Kier DeLea's face, and he was the main guy, and I barely remember his face. I know he died.
Open the pod bay doors. Yeah, how right. That's that line spoken by him.
You know, like. Kubrick was a fantastic photographer.
He had a great eye. He had a great eye. I think Lucas has a similar eye, because I look at something like 2001, and then I look at like
Lucas
THX, and THX has got that same minimalism, and it's got that same kind of like composition, and I really like it.
Lucas can imagine a fantastic world, and make it so full and so rich of detail. The Indiana Jones world was like that, and he really came up with the idea. And Spielberg was like, "Oh, you know, the old story about them on the beach in Hawaii."
Yeah, exactly. I have no real problem with Spielberg. I think that some of it, he has a certain, like, there's definitely an auteurism to a lot of what he does, but he's done stuff that really didn't fit that initial, like, sort of whimsical sensibility. Pretty much, I don't think he's done a lot of anything since Schindler's List. Like, what has he done that fit? I mean, AI maybe a little, but that was kind of a Kubrick-based story.
That fit what?
That sort of, like, the E.T., Jurassic Park kind of stuff. Oh, he did Lost World, I guess, because that was a sequel to Jurassic, but that was even a little more dark, I think. Then there's different directors that don't so much fit that. There's like narrative directors, the beginning, a middle, and end, a story that grips at your heartstrings with music crescendos and stuff. And then there's like the more, I don't know, I guess you call them more personal, maybe even sometimes more esoteric, because they write stuff to characters. I think Jim Jarmusch is admittedly sort of this way. In something like Down by Law, which I saw recently, he basically wanted to write a movie to see his friend Tom Waits and his friend John Lurie like interact. And right. So he's like, well, where's a good place to have him interact? Oh, put them both really in jail.
Self-indulgent.
It is, yeah.
Crap, really.
But, I mean, it was an all right movie in some spots. It just kind of doesn't really have a clear ending. Mm-hmm. They kind of walk their separate ways on a path after they've escaped from prison. But you get a different kind of viewing experience, and you get something different from a film like that. It's tough for me because I mentioned that Factorum film, which is a character study film, where I felt like this was a waste of time. Mm-hmm. Down by Law, I don't so much feel like that, because it's almost like either you enjoy the humor in the interactions of the characters, or you enjoy the character, or you don't. And so I think those films are kind of hit and miss. With films that are more cut and dry, narrative, beginning, middle, and end, you kind of try to go by genre, I guess. And then you're like, I know that, like, the peak action sequence where the good guy's about to die, and then he stands up and the music kicks ass, and then he, like, jumps on a surfboard and then machine guns the bad guys. That's going to be awesome, and it's going to make me feel
all intense. Are you talking about Escape from L.A.?
Sure. Something like that. But you know what I mean?
As soon as you're done,
I'm done.
On your soapbox, I'll tell you a few things.
Okay.
So, first of all, I hate the phrase character study.
Okay.
Because I think it's a way of people cheating and calling a boring movie something good. Because here's the thing. Here's really what all movies come down to. No matter what you've heard about some famous film, famous French film, that's about, oh, the interaction of this character and his environment or something like that. what a movie comes down to, when you watch it, after you watch a Fellini film, you realize, oh, that movie had a plot. The movie was about this thing that happened.
Like Eight and a Half, you know? This guy kind of goes nuts when he's trying to direct
something that happens. And that's what makes the movie interesting, is the plot. It's not like, you know what? That movie bored the hell out of me, but that character's realization of his own mortality was fascinating. Yeah. No, it's not like that. There's something that happens in the plot causes a pair to do something. Gone Baby Gone, if it doesn't end the way it does, it's kind of a boring movie. But it's the plot and the twists and turns that happens and the decision the character makes is not just a character study thing. No. It's a plot.
So you need a good plot and a good character.
This is what I think differentiates something with a couple of indie filmmakers. You mentioned Jarmusch. I respect some things Jarmusch does. I don't like the guy. I don't like his films. I think they're crap. The difference between him and John Sayles is that John Sayles' plots are interesting. Yeah. And every once you go out of a John Sayles film and think, you know, that was a great character study. You think that was a good, well written movie. He's a good writer, first of all. Roger Corman.
He wrote Piranha.
Yeah, an Alligator or something like that too. But like Eight Men Out, Limbo. Men with Guns. What's the one with Matthew McConaughey? Lone Star.
Okay. Oh yeah, Lone Star. That's
brilliant.
Right.
I've seen plots, and there's actually like Hollywood type twists in them, where it's just you would almost call it a character study if it was filmed a little more weird or something like that with some Dutch angles or whatever.
Well,
like,
there are interesting characters in a film like that. Is the thing, and I think that's the real fullness. I think you're right. I
tend to think it's just a name for a weak movie that someone likes to call it.
A big crutch if it's like, well, see, it's a character study. If you're trying to criticize something based on on what you feel are flaws in the plot, and then someone just writes it off as, you don't get it. It's a character study. Yeah,
right.
Then it's like, okay.
It is using that as a crutch, you're right. No.
But some films can be more, sort of explicitly sent as, like, it's about this one character, American Splendor is a character study, but there is a plot. There is watching the events happen in this guy's life, and the events are either, and what he does
and
with
the events
are interesting,
based
on how he acts.
And that's usually what a movie comes down to. Is what happens in the movie interesting, or is it not?
And with good writers, they can still put interesting characters, even that, like the guy that's at the gas station for 2 minutes or less. Mm-hmm. And you get that with Coen Brothers, you get that.
Totally.
You get that on some level with like Tarantino, even where he like have somebody in it for like just a brief period of time, and it's just
the Big Lebowski is filled with characters like that.
Yeah,
John Turturro is that movie for
like
total 2 minutes
or something. 2 minutes,
seriously, if that, including the flashback showing him walk up to the guy's house in Hollywood and tell him he's a pederast.
Yeah,
so you're right; they excel at that, and they put so many details about each character into it. You could almost call those character study movies, but they're not. They're like genre experiments and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, we want to make a Raymond Chandler film.
I think that's usually what the Coens do. It seems like they really just do genre experiments. Yeah.
But let's see how we can make this in our own style. Uh-huh. And they do it, you know?
There's no
mistaking their style in any movie. It's obviously their movie, you know?
Yeah.
They like wide angle.
Wide angle.
Like wide angle close-ups.
It's a good thing.
But that said, I specifically remember times where we've been talking about a movie that's really interesting that is a more dramatic thing. I've called it a character study, and you've agreed with me. So I don't think it's always a crutch, but like you said, it can be used to talk about a boring film, and then it can be used to talk about an incredibly exciting film where the character is just still a little more exciting than the actual events of the film, which is a testament to the writing. Like you said,
it really is. Well, I think usually where that is going on is that it's like the protagonist's sort of supersedes the plot.
Yeah,
it's like if it's just a general narrative, then
the plot pushes the protagonist.
Yeah. But if the protagonist pushes the plot,
which is like Gone Baby Gone, really, it's at least at the very end of it, that I think you could really kind of safely say that might be a character study. That I wouldn't call it so much. That's still a plot film because he doesn't up until that moment cause the film to happen or anything. Mm. If the protagonist is moving on, something like, for instance, that was brought up in our screenwriting class, an officer and a gentleman or something like that.
Yeah.
The film is based around the actions of the protagonist or something like that. You know, it's a study in classes because it's written a certain way and it's boring as hell drama.
So for me, that's the whole point, is that I think a lot of times you start with an interesting character. Maybe that's what you start with as a writer. But
that's my favorite thing.
Jarmusch is kind of a pretentious piece of crap because he kind of He's like, I just don't...
I tell you, I base a lot
too many strings attached with American money, and I just want to be able to...
What I think about him is...
The French really like him. That's probably what the biggest... Maybe they like these character studies with quotes, you know?
I think that they like everything that's un-American seeming. And so if something doesn't look like a Hollywood blockbuster, they're like, I think they're prone to more to accept it and look at the intricate details of it. And they're good at putting details in things. You know, there's some great...
But then again, you have the French New Wave guys that are clearly telling stories.
I didn't think I was going to like New Wave stuff. I think the trick about New Wave stuff is those were all guys who loved the American movies. And they loved Hitchcock, and they loved, like, you know.
They pulled the old switcheroo.
Things like Breathless and Jules and Jim and stuff do get a little slow at times. But
Jules and Jim is kind of tough.
But they're generally entertaining films. I didn't like it. Performances in them. And
I didn't like that at all.
They have interesting, you know, filming techniques.
Well, because that's all historically based around the new cameras that came out. Yeah, they were more mobile and stuff. So that's sort of the two different directing styles, I guess. And I think in terms of writing, I have to agree with you that you need an interesting plot. Things have to happen in the story. Story about that, which is where it's tough to tell an interesting story about a uncompelling protagonist, a protagonist that's a passive character. Like we've talked about it multiple times, Idiocracy. The Luke Wilson character is just kind of like, I don't really see what's going on. His energy level ranges from like 2 to maybe 6,
and
maybe
at
like
a little
peak.
Exasperated. Yeah.
But other than that,
it's still a straight man thing. Yeah. He's a straight man.
But it's not even just that he's a straight man. It's just that, like, you have no, like, you don't care about
him.
There's
two different types of comedy. When the main character, or the characters you spend the most time on is the straight man, that's a certain thing. And you have a lot of funny stuff happening around it. Idiocracy is one of those things. I would almost put Arrested Development in there, except for I think you spend just as much time on the side characters as you do on Michael.
Yeah.
He's the straight man. He still has funny moments. He has really funny moments.
Yeah.
Because he has his own flaws.
Yeah, exactly.
You take something like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, the main characters are the most whacked
out there. It's the same as Seinfeld. They're all just like control.
They're worse than Seinfeld.
They're worse, but they're...
they're terrible people.
It's almost like... I feel how someone could... I love that show. Mm-hmm. I just watched a couple episodes recently, the one with like, it becomes a gay bar. And,
yes,
and then
the first episode.
And then they're both like, no, we're going to do... we're going to do... No.
Dennis decides to do it because he gets hit on.
Yeah.
His vanity kicks in. Yeah.
And then the one where Charlie thinks that he's a dad and this kid's just
I loved it. That was the second episode. I love that because he gets these like Al Pacino bursts of rage where his voice gets super high. And when he tells the kid he's going to punch his face into a jelly, I love that because it looked like he ad-libbed it. He goes, I'm going to pound your face into a jelly. Like he's screaming it. I got to tell you, I've always liked the show. My favorite moment, and when I saw it, I just about lost it. It's the one where the stain of the Virgin Mary is on the wall.
Yeah.
And Mac is the one who's inexplicably brings up his Catholic religion sometimes, and the rest of them look at him like crazy, like, you're the worst person out of all.
Yeah.
I would say Dennis is probably a worse person than him, but he's a close second. Like, he tries to be bad, and he can't be quite as bad as Dennis, you know, because Dennis is just naturally that way.
Uh-huh.
And then he brings up the religion thing. Oh, I can't do this thing. But he's terrible at all times, and he suddenly decides, my religion is kicking in. And so then... Charlie, for no reason whatsoever, decides he's going to try to butt in on Mac's religious thing where he's trying to get all pious and stuff, and he's wearing the black priest type outfit. Yeah. And Charlie comes in wearing the white southern preacher outfit, and he comes dancing in, like, really weird, like, and he's singing a song about the Holy Spirit going down on me, and Mac's like, what are you singing? Like, and they basically, like, their plot line is, they're having this competition to see who can get more religious followers, and Charlie just killed me in that thing. Like, I love his character. I Mac used to be my favorite, and Charlie's by far my favorite character. And I love the guy.
Yeah,
those characters are, you know, the funny thing is that they push the plot absolutely because they do nothing but make wrong decisions, bad decisions based on their vanity, sloth, greed, pride. all the stupidity. And it's but generally the stupidity is kind of a side product of the fact that they're the first decision that comes to mind is how can I best benefit myself out of this situation? They're bad people. They're bad guys.
Screw somebody else ever, right?
You take an Adam Sandler movie where he's kind of he is actually kind hearted underneath. Yeah. Those are the bad guys in the movie, is that type of guy. Uh-huh. And they're the main characters in the show. And like you said, that was really Seinfeld too. There was nothing altruistic around any.
That's why they all ended up in jail.
Exactly, yeah, because that's what they deserve. They should have been put to death.
It was a clip show, and then they were in jail.
Jerry is the most vain, like nitpicky, you know, like. But it was done in a nicer, like, sitcom.
Yeah.
It's Always Sunny is, like, beating you over the head with the fact these are terrible
Which
people.
Is the only potential criticism is it's, like, it's they almost push, like, yeah. like the recent Curb Your Enthusiasm is almost, like, such a contrivance under the to create this humor of this unlikable character. It's, like, how do you maintain
those situations are pretty funny.
And, we love that stuff. Yeah. We love Arrested Development. But those are why shows like that, I mean, I'm surprised something like It's Always Sunny is able to, like, is it getting a fourth season? I think it is.
It is, yeah. It costs them nothing to make it.
Maybe if Arrested Development had been cheaper or not on the main network, it would have, because I think that's the same problem. I mean, they even made a joke about it in Arrested Development. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I think we're just not likable enough. I don't know, it was in the context of, you know, but it making like a fourth wall kind of thing. Yeah, and it's like, but there was even a couple characters were like, George Michael was likable, because he was just sort of dumbfounded the whole time.
He was dumbfounded always.
And he was trying to do right, and he had this little awkward thing with his cousin.
And he was constantly tempted by his cousin, who was not his cousin.
And Michael was like trying to do well by everybody, but he had a certain kind of bravado or arrogance he almost needed in order to keep doing it, you know what I mean? If he just didn't have that, he would just give
and
it
a lot
up.
Of his antagonism came out of his treatment of George Michael, because he did the thing where he was always disapproving of whatever the girlfriend was, who was
Anne?
Her?
Yeah.
Her?
Anne?
That one, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about going on a trip with her.
Her? Really?
That's how you, that's how you referred to her. And, yeah. I think that they put real human elements into something like the rest of Development.
That's what people don't want to see sometimes, right? And that's
but those characters were really more cartoony than other shows, for sure. Yeah. Like, more so than Seinfeld, even. The Buster character was completely unbelievable. Hilarious, but unbelievable. Yeah. The mother was so evil. That was unbelievable. The sister was way too self-absorbed for reality.
I
love the Job character, because they always get down to, you know, every few episodes, they get back into the thing where he's just so insecure, and he's the one, obviously, who his father hates the most.
Yeah.
That he's just that he builds this shell of absolute bravado and misplaced self-assurance into this fantastic, like, you know, machismo of this character. And when it breaks apart, it's always him sniveling and like, I want you to love me, to Michael and to his father and everyone I just keep thinking of the thing where Super Dave was the surrogate. When Super Dave was talking to Job, or no, Buster was talking through the thing after his dad had left the room, and Job was almost crying with happiness, because he's like, "We're gonna do this project together," and he's like, "Yeah, sure," because Buster just wanted to play with somebody. Uh-huh. Basically, he wants to build the tiny house and make the Japanese believe that the tiny thing on the hill is the real
Godzilla,
one.
Yeah.
Oh man. That show was just like, the interesting thing about that show, this is a little aside here, but if you didn't have the narration constantly explaining everything, it doesn't work, because they crammed 15 seasons worth of material into 3 seasons.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you get one episode, and you're getting almost like a whole season of a sitcom put in there, because here's some backstory, here's something that happened in the future, and he's explaining every single thing. Normally, something like that wouldn't work, but the show is so
brilliant. I'd say it's like the equivalent of like one, I think it's like a 3-to-1 ratio, probably, where, you know.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
There's definitely a lot going on.
You take out a narration there, and you have to rely on the fact that the audience is going to get it. When you explain it, you even get an opportunity for more jokes. I don't think I think if someone else tries to emulate that, it won't work.
So it's just one of those rules of comedy. It works a little better, you know, for comedy than it does for drama.
It does.
I'm not going to cry about that show being done, though, because I feel like it was all good, and it was a good chunk. And if it had gone on longer, it would have either just gotten really, it would have started rehashing. It would have gotten so contrived, they would have had to make the characters so unlikable. So certain kinds of comedy based around those kinds of really complex things can only last for so long before they, like, how can you even maintain
that? I think, though, that one mistake shows make is that they try to change at some point, introduce new elements, and change things up, because, like, oh, that'll bring a new audience.
Well, it's the whole thing, like, in The Simpsons when they brought Roy in, remember?
Right, episode of Roy? Yeah, exactly, something like that.
Mrs. S, what's going on?
Yeah, and dramas and stuff do it to varying success. Usually it doesn't work. After you take out David Duchovny and bring in Agent Doggett of the X-Files, it really
the T-1000.
Just, viewership just goes, and they go, yeah, we got to end this. We got to end it. So
after two seasons. That's a mistake.
Because what people want is the same thing over and over. And it ends up, with Seinfeld was the same, almost the same plot over and over. Curb Enthusiasm, things don't really change that are that big in them. I think it's Always Sunny could last for a very long time. And it will be something I'll be sad to see go, because the sameness of it is what's funny.
Well, but they've also brought new stuff in. They brought in the third season.
Well they do things like they kill off the mother. They bring in the new dad.
They bring in Frank.
Yeah. Then Frank, and then Frank is actually Charlie's dad. Like they change stuff like that around, but it still doesn't change the fact that those huge things happen, but they're still concerned about little petty stupid things. And that's what.
I mean, you need to see the third season, dude. The third season.
Yeah, I've only seen a couple episodes of it.
It's just hilarious. You're talking about, like, adding characters and sort of changing things up.
Yeah, changing things, like, in a big way. Where suddenly you change the main character or something like that.
Well, okay, that doesn't work. Like you said about the X-Files, that was kind of dumb. It was kind of like it was becoming clear they were just trying to create a new Mulder and Scully. That show had gone on too long. I think Carter maybe didn't know what he was doing to end it. You know, he didn't. Yeah. And so that sucks. That show was fantastic till about season six, and then it started just getting, like, whatever.
I thought the standalone episodes were great, and I never loved the ones that linked it all together, because they were always so convoluted.
They were really convoluted at the beginning, but that kind of the series
and even the movie, it still didn't explain exactly what was going on.
That's the problem, is that he hadn't really quite committed to the ending. Yeah,
they swear they have an ending to this thing.
Well, they're getting towards something. I've been watching a couple episodes. I haven't seen the last four.
They swear, I guarantee you, they will not be able to tie this whole thing up, and when they do, it's going to be loose thread city with crap
I'm sure
does not make sense, and then people are going to be bitching about for hundreds of years.
Oh, I don't doubt. Hundreds, thousands. I think two millennia at least.
Yeah.
Here's a counterexample, where you can make it work well. I mean, growth of a good show or a good idea will introduce new characters, because some characters will leave, some characters will come in. The relationships will change. You know, friends become enemies, enemies become friends, and braver for the journey or whatever.
Right.
The Wire. Best thing ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm being facetious, but I do think it's a good show. Every single season of The Wire, they bring back some of the old characters, they introduce new characters, they change things up.
Right.
The first season is just about the corners with Avon Barksdale and basically assembling this special crime unit to observe them. And then you know, stuff happens and some characters get moved around. In the second season, they kill off some of the characters that were pretty big in the first season. But it's about the dock workers union.
Right.
And a little bit about how, like, that works to, you know, bringing drugs
in. It's all
in.
About the Baltimore thing, about the urban decay.
Well, the whole show overriding theme is sort of about the inner workings and politics of Baltimore. Yeah.
Right.
And there's urban decay is a part of it. But then there's also, by season four, with this mayor race and everything, it's all about sort of, like, growth and changing things and development on some level. The point is that each new season, there's a handful of new characters you have to get introduced to that you either care about or you don't care about, and they have no compunction about killing somebody off that has been, like, relevant in the show for a good period of time. Mm-hmm. Now, to some level, that was my criticism to my friend who was saying, you got to watch this, it's great. And I'm like, okay, but am I going to get into a whole bunch of characters in season one that are then going to, like, not be there anymore, and, like, I want to see more of that? Like, you know, like, the main character is ostensibly, like, Jimmy McNulty.
Yeah.
But he becomes ancillary, very ancillary. Apparently, in the fourth season, I've only watched two episodes of it, but I don't think he was in anything. He was in the second episode at all.
I read that he's back in the fifth a great deal.
It's possible that they would have to kind of bring him back. But
going on what you're saying, I was reading some. Every time I open any newspaper, I go on my lunch to different restaurants and stuff at work, and I open newspapers, and there's always a story in the arts section or whatever about The Wire. Almost always. Any different newspaper.
Well, I don't want to... Don't
New York spoilers. Times. I won't spoil anything. One thing they do say was... So the fifth season just ended, or it's about to end.
It's like 10 episodes.
Last show is coming up.
Three episodes left or something like that.
Something like that. So, no, actually, I think the finale is actually airing.
So they're only doing 11 episodes this season? Okay.
And they say exactly what you're explaining about the changing. They say they say this new one about the, it's about the newspaper.
The media,
the,
yeah.
The media thing. They
each
say,
one has a theme.
Yeah,
each
they say this theme. this new season was the weakest because of that. Of that thing, this newspaper thought. I think this was the Chronicle, maybe, or News USA Today. That's what it was. And they said, you know, and they explained exactly what you just did. But I think the point was, eventually, the change, and the main reason this is getting canceled now, they didn't renew it, is because the ratings took a massive nosedive after the fourth season. Because, like you said, it changes so drastically that it ends up kind of killing it off, and the viewership declines.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's still brilliant, which everyone claims it is. So.
That's I also think
and a comedy won't do that. Friends,
Family Guy,
Friends ratings won't.
Family Guy still got that. High ratings, right?
Family Guy,
but it's completely got reactionary. Like I'll admit, I still can watch one and
I'll
laugh
watch
a couple
every
times.
One and I'll
but
laugh
I'm not one of those people that's like completely over it or like yeah. Because South Park aptly yeah. made fun of it, and South Park hit the nail on the head.
I gotta tell you, I get sick of South Park too.
I ain't got nowhere else to go. And then they get in the mad.
Yeah, and there's awesome songs. Awesome
songs lift up. With Joe Cocker?
Yep.
You always got to have a Joe Cocker
song
in every movie that you ever do.